You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 297, Exodus 25, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Pretty good. I'm still into the Ark of the Covenant, so still wearing my jacket.
Are you actually wearing it right now as we're recording?
I'm not, but I've worn it a lot. I actually, you know, this whole jacket thing has a bit of a story. I don't know. Do I even want to get into this?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I found the manufacturer that made the jacket, you know, for the movies. Okay. And the movies have different jackets. They're all quite similar, but there are slight differences. So I thought, man, you know, I've been thinking for literally over 20 years. People are going to think I'm some kind of head case when I tell this story, but I've been thinking about this for 20 years. And I'd really like to get this jacket, but I have a habit of ruining things. And so I have been afraid to get this jacket. Because it's, you know, it's a little pricey. It's like lambskin leather. I mean, it's not like ridiculous. And I have refused to buy it. I mean, my kids and Drina, you buy this thing, you quit talking about it, blah, blah, blah. 20 years. So I finally bought it. And it's not ruined yet. I've had it for a couple of weeks. It's
awesome.
Not ruined yet. So I don't know how long it'll last, but I'm just paranoid about it.
Does it actually come with, is it like limited edition? Is like, I mean, it's
not a limited edition, but you have, they go through all the things that are on the original, you know, that this company made for Harrison Ford. And then you can pick a little, like, do you want an extra pocket on the inside? You know, like his didn't have that. I mean, it'll tell you what the original one had and what you could add to it. So it gives you a little flexibility unless you're like a zealot, you know, I want like the jacket. So I did get an extra pocket, so I'm not too much of a zealot, I guess, but yep, I've had it 2 weeks and it's not ruined yet. So
that's good. Now we just need to get you the hat and the whip.
Right.
I think I've got a whip somewhere.
Yeah. I have a hat in my Fringe Pop studio, but that's pretty
actually
alien.
As a kid, I had the hat and I had a bull whip, except I cracked the whip one time and it came back and hit my chin. I kid you not. Isn't that what happened to him?
Do you have a scar? That's what happened to him. So, right. Do you have a scar?
No, I don't have a scar, but it made me bleed and it popped my lip and it hurt so bad that I don't think I cracked it again because it hurt so bad. And then later on, that was before Indiana Jones 3 came out, because that's when we discovered how he got his scar. And I was like, yep, that happened to me. That can happen.
All right. Like, is that like more nerdy than mine? I think that is more nerdy than mine. Or I don't know. Well, I just don't want to ruin it. But you're living the story.
Well, I was just a kid, you know. I lived out in the country, so I had the bullwhip, and I was a kid just playing. I wasn't playing Indiana Jones necessarily. I was just playing with my bullwhip. Cracked that thing, it hit my lip, and whoo, it hurt so bad, it was bleeding. I didn't touch it again because painful.
Yeah.
But and then I saw it in the movie, and I was like, yep, that can happen. Been there, done that. But I don't have a jacket. If I had the jacket, if I were you, I would like go outside and roll around or something, you know, like.
No.
You're scared.
No, I'm just. It's just freaking me out. Still, I just know I'm going to ruin this thing.
Well, that's awesome. Well, we're glad you got the jacket. We hope it inspires. This episode here. So we're ready.
All right, this is going to be part two, Ark of the Covenant. And if you listened to the last one, we talked about what the Ark was, what it did, what it didn't do. And we sort of, again, laid a few breadcrumbs out for this episode. Specifically, I pointed out last time Egyptian sorts of things that are in the narrative that are associated with the Ark. Because our subject matter for today is going to be the question of ancient Near Eastern parallels. And again, just like with the last episode, I'm not going to talk in this one about what happens to the Ark. That's episode 158. We're going to focus in on this one particular question because I'm sure, again, it's probably a question in the minds of a number of listeners, you know, because, you know, you run into this situation where, you know, oh, well, you know, there can't be like laws similar in the ancient world and the Hittites and the Egyptians and the Babylonians that are similar to the laws of the Torah, because it's the Torah and it's from God. And so it has to be unique. It can't be like anything else. Well, really? Like, why? This is one of those. Okay, so I want you to set your mind in that mode. I'm going to start with a theological and historicist question. Okay, if the tabernacle, the ark, and the other furniture in the tabernacle conform to or were derivative from other ancient Near Eastern objects in some way, does that render Exodus 25:9 and Exodus 25:40 incomprehensible or make those verses untrue? Now, we read verse 9 last time. I'm just going to read it again. Exodus 25, 10 through 22 is the ark section of Exodus 25. But right before that, in verse 9, you get this. God says to Moses, you know, do all this stuff exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle and of all its furniture, so shall you make it. And then verse 40 says, and see that you make them after the pattern for them, which is being shown you on the mountain. So the text is telling us that God is going to give, or either has given or is going to give Moses a pattern by which to create these things, to make these things. So if that's the case, you know, God's given the pattern, and we find out that there are other ancient Near Eastern objects, either similar to the tabernacle or the ark or some other piece of the ark's or the tabernacle's furniture. Do we have a problem here? I would suggest the answer is no. We need to ask ourselves some questions, okay? Two questions here. One, why would we think that the command, verses 9 and verse 40, why would we think that the command to follow the pattern rules out similarity to ancient Near Eastern objects? Why would we think that? What about the wording, quote, make these things the way I show you, unquote, forbids similarity? Where's the coherence in that? The command doesn't say, make these things and make sure they're not like anything else in the world or like anything else you've ever seen. It doesn't say that. Okay, so that's the first question. Why would we think the command rules out similarity to other ancient Near Eastern objects? Second, why would God care about giving Moses a pattern in the first place? Maybe similarity would serve a purpose. Familiarity. Maybe God wanted a comparison made for the purpose of highlighting points of contrast as well. You know, is there anything wrong with God giving Moses a pattern, and the pattern is like something that Moses already knows or has seen? Is there some like cosmic rule against that? Is there some, you know, something that forbids God from doing that again? I don't see a problem here. So I hope it's clear that by asking, you know, these two initial questions, that again helps me, you know, to kind of telegraph how I'm going to look at this thing, you know, because our topic again is, you know, this whole notion of there being an ancient Near Eastern antecedent to the Ark of the Covenant. And a lot of people would be troubled by that and are troubled by that. But again, I just don't think that it's something that we need to be troubled by. So having asked those questions, let's just jump in here. And by way of review, at least a little bit, last time we really just focused on what's the Ark? You know, what is it? What was it for? How did it function? And we read a selection from the Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch by Dick Averbeck that sort of summarized what the Ark was. I'm going to read just a few sentences of that. Averbeck wrote, "The ark was the most important piece of furniture in the tabernacle. It was placed in the inner sanctum of the tent called the Most Holy Place, or Holy of Holies, you'll see in translations. Averbeck says, the cover on the top of the ark was called the atonement seat, the kaporet, from the verb kipper, to make atonement, and it was overshadowed by two gold cherubim." And again, we don't sort of know the mental picture because of the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark and whatnot. So that is quite familiar. Averbeck goes on and he says now the Lord would meet with Moses above the lid. Again, so usually translated mercy seat, or here in Averbeck, atonement seat. The Lord would meet with Moses there, and they would have conversations, and Moses would get information. So the ark was something of an oracle at times. It was also the depository of the two stone tablets of the law, which the Lord was, you know, about to give Moses on the mountain. Again, we've of course gone over that at length here in the series on Exodus. The ark, therefore, was called the Ark of the Testimony in certain passages, Exodus 25:22, for instance, or the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, Numbers 10:33, because the tablets were the sort of the covenant documents, and these are deposited within the ark, and so that's where the ark gets its name. So that's, again, sort of the brief introduction, you know, to what the ark was. We actually sort of summarized Averbeck and a few other quotations with a few sentences about the ark. I might as well just, you know, hit those real quickly. Again, the ark is a box made of wood, plated with gold. The lid, the so-called atonement seat or mercy seat, it's just the lid. That's actually what the term means, lid. Was solid gold. It was made of acacia wood, and we noted last time that the term there, shittim, is a term that derives from Egyptian. And again, we're going to come back to that in a moment. The ark, of course, was associated with God's presence. Again, Moses would meet with God there. So it had this oracular function. The ark was a sign of Yahweh's presence. It would often, you know, be taken into battle because, again, the Lord was with this thing in some way. However, the ark did not contain God. We pointed this out last time. Again, this is sort of Hollywood and Graham Hancock mythology. I mean, there's no passage that ever says God was in the ark or that God spoke from or out of the ark. There's nothing like that. Again, God would you know, meet with Moses above the lid. So God is not in the ark. The only thing the ark contains is the tablets of the covenant. We talked last time about how the pot of manna and the rod of Aaron, again, that gets misunderstood as being inside the ark. That's not the case. We looked at a few verses about that. And of course, 1 Kings 8:9 said specifically that the only thing in the ark were the two tablets of stone. So again, that just by way of summary, that's the Ark of the Covenant. Now, I mentioned an article in the first part one, of Exodus 25. It was by Scott Nogel. That's N-O-E-G-E-L. And you can access this online, The Egyptian Origin of the Ark of the Covenant. So right away in the title, you know, Nogel is telegraphing the fact that he thinks that the Ark of the Covenant sort of came from Egypt in some way. And that article is from a book called Israel's Exodus in Transdisciplinary Perspective. Springer is the publisher, 2015. It's quite a good book. I have this. It's a major scholarly work with an assortment of essays about the Exodus, and this is one of those. Nogel, in this article, again, early on, if you're reading it, he notes the acacia wood thing, the Hebrew term shittah, again, Egyptian loan word, and then he adds this again. So he's very upfront with where he's going in this article, of course, by the title, and then he says this, I think it's like in the first couple paragraphs. He says, biblical texts describe the Ark of the Covenant as a sacred object containing five major features. First is a wooden box. The Hebrew term there is aron, roughly 4 feet by 2.5 by 2.5 feet and overlaid with gold. The second, again, feature is a lid. That's the kaporet, made entirely of gold, not plated like the box. Third component was a pair of gold cherubim. Okay. And this is what he actually has. He has, in other words, sphinxes that rest on the top of the lid and face each other with their wings touching. So Nogel, you know, right away sort of makes this assumption, this presumption in the text of his article that the cherubim were sphinxes, which is obviously an Egyptian thing. And you might wonder, well, how in the world, how can you make this equation? Because, you know, if you've read Unseen Realm 2, you're going to know this, but you might also know it from other things we've done here in the podcast, like the Ezekiel series. In Ezekiel chapter 1, there are cherubim, and chapter 10, and that's an Akkadian term. So how can you look at this Akkadian, you know, Babylonian, if you will, term, and think that we're looking at Egyptian sphinxes? You know, you have to ask yourself, you know, would the writer, you know, let's whether it's Moses or not, okay, would the writer, again, setting the story in Egypt, if these were really Egyptian entity figures, these supernatural figures, again, Cherubim, using that term, these are supernatural throne guardians. They were supposed to be guardians of sacred space, which, you know, makes sense if they're on top of the ark. But if you're writing the story and you have this Egyptian context all over the place, why would you use the word Cherubim? You know, because it's an Akkadian term. It doesn't feel like it makes sense. And then, of course, Nogal just assumes that they're sphinxes. And you have to wonder what he's thinking here. Well, you know, he's going to get into the subject and really sort of lay out his case for an Egyptian antecedent to the Ark of the Covenant, that the Ark of the Covenant really sort of derives from something very specifically Egyptian. Now, before he does that, he takes some time to debunk proposed non-Egyptian parallels to the Ark, specifically two of them. One is the Assyrian palanquin. A palanquin is like, you know, think of the way you see sometimes, even in modern times, like 19th century, you see important people carried in essentially a little chair suspended from poles. It's just, you know, it's a thing that people got carried around in. Okay, that's a palanquin. So other cultures had these things. The Assyrians had them, as we're going to see. The Egyptians had them as well. They're not always styled the same, but he starts with the Assyrian model, if you will, and it debunks it because it really doesn't have any of the features of the Ark of the Covenant. For instance, Assyrian palanquins had no poles to carry them. They were, you know, moved around in different methods. There was no box to it. There's no lid. It's not covered in gold. It, you know, they never historically contained any relics or important texts like documents, like covenants and all that. I mean, it literally doesn't have any real parallel other than the fact that you could carry somebody in this thing. That's about it. So Nogal, I think, does a good job of saying, you know, this is a proposal and it's just really not worth our time. The second one is a Bedouin object. This is something from, you know, more either South Arabian or, you know, Syria, Palestine, you know, Israel, Canaan, that area, especially with the Bedouin lifestyle. It's something called, it goes by different names, the Utfa or the Markav. And right away you might think Merkava there. That's, again, it's this carrying vehicle. The Utfa, Markav, or the Kuba. Now, if you've read Graham Hancock's book, The Sign and the Seal, which is quite old by now, it's, you know, 20-some years old, he sort of tracks on the Kuba a lot in what he writes about the Ark. But these three terms, again, refer to sort of an object that would be put on top of horses or camels, and then people would sit in them, or you would ride in them. But again, there's no box. There's no lid. There's no poles. You know, you wouldn't carry important documents in them like covenant tablets or anything like that. So again, Nogal, I think, does a good job of saying, well, this one might be a little better than the Assyrian explanation, but there's just too many disconnections here. And it's because of those disconnections and because all, and we're serious here, all of the Ark's features do have some sort of parallel in Egyptian palanquins, that Nogal says, this is the best view. This is the best parallel to the Ark of the Covenant. Now, Egyptian palanquins, it's kind of interesting. I was just on the East Coast for an interview in New York City, and we had a few hours in the last morning I was there. We went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I should probably put these on the website since they're my pictures along with this episode. But there were a few Egyptian paintings there that had palanquins in them. And so I thought, hey, here's a good opportunity to take a few pictures because this is what we're talking about. So the Egyptian palanquin was a box, all right? And it could be carried by poles. Not all the models were. Typically, the Egyptian palanquin was put inside another structure, sort of like a boat or a ship, you know, something that looked like a longboat with, you know, curled ends. And it was typically pushed or dragged along. But it could be, and some of the models were, like in King Tut's tomb, there are pictures of palanquins with poles. They're boxed with poles, just like the Ark of the Covenant, and very, very close to the actual size as well. So, you know, there were different models of this. And so Nogal argues for the Egyptian palanquin carried on these Egyptian boats that are referred to by Egyptologists as sacred barks. And that'll either be spelled B-A-R-K-S or B-A-R-Q-U-E-S, sacred boats. So again, this is going to be where he argues. There are more parallels to it that we'll get into in a moment. But this is the direction he goes. I want you to see the direction he goes and why. The Assyrian view doesn't really work. Again, there's too many disconnections. The same thing for the Bedouin, Kuba, it doesn't work. There's just too many dissimilarities. And there are so many close similarities with the Egyptian model. Now, I'm going to read a few selections from Nogal as to the data upon which he draws this conclusion. So I've given you sort of the surface thing. Egypt had these boxes, then some of them had poles, and they were carried around. Okay, but here's the real nuts and bolts from Nogal's article. I'm just skipping around in the article here. He writes, the bark's most basic function was to transport gods and mummies. When transporting gods, the bark was fitted with a gold-plated naos. That's a Greek term for like an inner sanctum, like a holy. Either a holy place, like an inner room, or again, sort of a space within a space that was especially holy, especially sanctified, for the carrying of the divine image, this divine, an idol in Egypt's case. So the bark was fitted with a gold-plated naos containing a divine image seated on a hut block, that's an Egyptian term, hut block throne, which was veiled with a thin canopy of wood or cloth. Many barks were decorated with protective cherubim. This is Nogal's word. Again, cherubim is not an Egyptian term. This is Nogal writing. He says, many barks were decorated with protective cherubim. Like the Ark of the Covenant, sacred barks were carried on poles by priests, the so-called pure ones, who had performed purification rituals in order to hoist the bark. Though most Egyptian rituals were never witnessed by the public, the procession of the sacred bark was an important exception. I mean, they would do this before people. Nogal also says the bark also gave oracles. While resting at one of the stations that it was, carried around, on its journey, it would be consulted by written oracles, and while en route during the procession, it would be asked a question to which it would respond yes or no, by bowing fore and aft. Let me just stop there. So here you have this box, this gold-plated box, again, that itself could be carried by poles. Inside of it is the deity image. But it's resting on this boat-like craft, okay, that's getting dragged, through the desert, all right? And so it would stop, and people would ask it questions. And, there's somebody probably tipping it. If it tips one way, the answer is yes. If it tips the other way, the answer is no. But they would do this. They would ask it questions. It was the bark was considered a source of divine knowledge, revelation being dispensed from the deity. Back to Nogal. He says, some priests marched before the bark, wafting incense, and others alongside and behind. Some bore standards representing gnomes. A gnome is like a county in Egypt, a district, geographical region or district in Egypt. The term they used was gnomes. So some bore standards representing gnomes, much like the tribal procession of the Ark of the Covenant, with the tribes carrying these flag standards, around. And they're on all sides of the Ark. So Nogal's, building this picture, this case. Nogal continues. He says, while I know of no sacred bark whose footstool contained relics, the placing of oaths beneath the feet of statues is attested. Thus, in a letter from Ramses II to the Hittite king Hattusilis III, we find the following reference, quote, the writing of the covenant that I made to the great king and which the king of Hattu has made with me lies beneath the feet of the god Ra. The great gods are witnesses to it, unquote. Nogal says, scholars have long likened this practice to the placing of the covenantal tablets in the ark's footstool. Again, the ark itself is referred to as God's footstool, and this is where the tablets went. Nogal says, I am not suggesting that the Ark of the Covenant was in fact a bark, an Egyptian bark, only that the bark served as a model, which the Israelites adapted for their own needs. Thus, the Israelites conceived of the ark not as an Egyptian boat with a prow and a stern and oars, but as a rectangular object more akin to the riverine boat that informs the shape of Noah's Ark. Now, let me just stop there. This is something you're going to see a lot. You see it in Hancock as well. The word for Noah's Ark is not the Hebrew word that's used for the Ark of the Covenant. And Nogle knows that, and he says it in the article, but therefore I don't know why these two things always get connected. They are not the same term. They don't have the same function. The Ark of Noah is the Teva. Okay? It's not the Aron. But again, you'll see this conflation all the time. So, you know, he's saying that, you know, I mean, just think of this. Again, this is just me now interjecting here. Nogle is building this case, and he says, okay, we have a box in Egypt that was carried around by poles, inside of which was a deity, and, you know, so, and it would function as an oracle, and people would surround it and carry banners. I mean, again, it sounds a lot like the Ark of the Covenant. And I'm not saying that these aren't legit parallels. I think basically they are. But then the fact that it's placed in a boat sort of makes the lights go off in their heads, and then their minds go to the Ark of Noah because that was a boat. Well, it just doesn't seem like a legitimate connection. They're never connected in Scripture. The words are different. The functions are different. The settings are different. Frankly, the context, one is clearly Babylonian, is different. And in fact, if Irving Finkel, you know, who wrote a book just a few years ago about the Ark, based upon new cuneiform information, it might have been a round, you know, object or something like that. There's a different way to look at what the Ark of Noah might have been shaped like. Okay, different than your standard, you know, rectangle. So there, again, without getting into how you deal with that with the measurements and all that stuff, I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail, but it's not the same object is the point. It's not, they don't look like each other. Again, the functions are different, the whole thing. So I just don't know why scholars feel sort of compelled to make this association when there just really isn't much of an association. Let's just stick with the Egyptian material, because that's fairly compelling in and of itself. I don't know why we have to go here, but anyway. Nogle continues, again, they conceive of the Ark as a rectangular object more akin to the riverine boat that informs the shape of Noah's Ark. Nevertheless, some of the bark's other aspects remain meaningful in Israelite thinking of the divine presence. It continued to be a sacred object that one could consult for oracles. This happens after the days of Moses, and we talked about a little bit about this last time in part one. And its maintenance continued to be the exclusive privilege of the priest and priestly culture. It still represented a throne and a footstool, and so it still served as a symbol of the divine presence. It continued to be a sacred object that one could consult for oracles, and its maintenance continued to be the exclusive privilege of the priests. Okay, so, you know, there we have, again, Nogle's basic description. So in Egypt had this box thing plated with gold. It was sometimes covered with wood, sometimes with a tent, and Nogle draws attention to that. Well, that's interesting because the Israelite Ark was in a tent. Not just the tabernacle, but the Holy of Holies was a complete tent, you know, tented, or, you know, it had curtains over the top and the sides, you know. So again, he says, hey, look at that. You know, that's even a parallel. Again, carried with poles, you could have, you know, the deity inside and whatnot. And they would take it out publicly and so on and so forth. So all of this that he mentions here, except for the Noah's Ark thing, you know, honestly, he has good sourcing for this. All of this is demonstrable from primary sources in Egypt. However, Nogle goes on to argue that the Ark, the Aron in Hebrew, was connected to Egypt in other ways. These arguments, in my view, are much less coherent than these primary source sort of connections. For example, Nogle notes that Aron is a word used in Genesis 50 for the coffins or the sarcophagi used to hold the bodies of Jacob and Joseph when they died and then when they were buried, when their deaths and burials are described. He goes on an excursus then about how burials and the cult of the dead in Egypt, you know, the Osiris cult, were also associated with threshing floors, something in the Hebrew Bible with which the Ark was associated. That's true. He further makes this association, you know, this threshing floor thing. He goes from that and he says, hey, remember that story about Dagon when the Ark is put before Dagon, the temple of Dagon? Dagon Dagon is a grain god. It's not a fish god, by the way. It's true. He's a grain deity. And so grain is associated with threshing floors. And so isn't that interesting, you know, how the Ark winds up in the Temple of Dagon, and Dagon's associated with threshing floors. And, of course, the Ark in some of the books of Samuel, you know, in Kings, it gets associated with threshing floors because this is, you know, one of the sites, you know, or the site that David, you know, arranges to have the temple built and all this kind of stuff, you know, the threshing floor of Arona. And so Nogal's saying, look, all of this is also Egyptian. Now, I personally have my doubts about this, especially when he tries to connect this to Osiris, you know, the cult of the dead, just because we use the same Hebrew term for coffin of Joseph and Jacob. This is a real stretch. You see, how can I say that? Well, I would just ask some questions. Let's just think about this a little bit. How would the Ark be associated with either death or resurrection? You know, Osiris dies, and then he doesn't physically resurrect, but he comes back to life in the underworld. He's the god of the underworld, okay? How's the Ark associated with either death or resurrection? It isn't. It isn't associated with either. You would think that if there's some sort of Osirian connection here, that somewhere the Ark would get that specific theological association, but it never does. It makes far more sense to note as well that threshing floors, okay, you don't have to say, well, threshing floors are interesting in the Hebrew Bible when the Ark is associated with them because of Osiris. And the Osiris cult, you know, was associated with threshing floor. Well, yeah, okay, but it makes more sense to note that threshing floors were associated with the harvest, and food production is, of course, essential to life. The Ark was the source of life because it was associated with the presence of Yahweh. You don't need anything from Egypt to make those associations. Further, why would the Philistines put the Ark into the Temple of Dagon? Did they really put the Ark into the Temple of Dagon because they thought to themselves, hey, this box is Egyptian? And Egyptian palanquins sometimes show up in scenes that include grain harvests. And the cult of Osiris is associated with the grain harvest just like Dagon. So the Ark belongs here. Is that really what they're thinking? A Philistine is thinking that? Again, that's really dubious. It's very dubious reasoning. It's so much more obvious that the Philistine storage of the Ark in Dagon's temple is a conquest gesture. They do it because they believe Yahweh was defeated by Dagon on the field of battle, so putting the Ark in Dagon's temple, his sacred space, is a gesture of Yahweh's defeat and submission to Dagon. That's why they do it. You don't need any connection to Osiris and threshing floors associated with Osiris to make sense of the 1 Samuel 5 story. You just don't. You know, another example, Nogal notes passages that mention the Ark and threshing floors and the festival of Sukkot, you know, the booths, you know, the festival of booths. Again, this has nothing to offer in the way of support for a connection to Egypt. The festival of Sukkot, yes, it has something to do with grain harvest as when it was held. Okay, we get it. But the festival of Sukkot commemorated Yahweh's deliverance of Israel from Egypt and from other gods during the Israelite journey through the wilderness, which was, of course, viewed as a place of chaos. So again, you just don't need anything from Egypt to see, you know, symbolically, emblematically, what's going on in any of these examples. You just don't need Egypt. You don't need Osiris. You don't need any of this stuff. So to me, this is sort of the weakest part of Nogal's article. I mean, he does a good job of ferreting out primary sources for the construction and shape and look and some of the functions of the Ark. Okay, that much is demonstrable. Well, when he goes on these rabbit trails, it's just really special pleading. I think really, honestly, I think it's kind of poor reasoning. So I think he overstates the data in those respects. But in the other respects, I think, you know, he marshals good evidence, and his case is workable. His argument is workable just generally. So let's think about what we've talked about to this point. Do we have, you know, let's just assume that Nogal, again, he's ferreted out this data, and let's just assume that he's right. You know, he's onto something, that there's this Egyptian antecedent. And by the way, we can already see the disconnects. Okay, Egyptian palanquins carried around deities, you know, idols. Again, Yahweh is never said to be in the Ark, ever. Not one verse. He's always above the lid. communicating with Moses. All right, so there are obvious disconnections, but yet the form of the ark and the form of these Egyptian palanquins, they're very close. Now, even the quote-unquote sphinxes or cherubim, okay, you will see pictures of, I don't know if any of mine, I should have looked before we got into this. It's been a little while before since I took the pictures, and I'm trying to remember the one in Tut's tomb. The one I'm thinking of, there were several in Tut's tomb, but there are some Egyptian palanquins that on the ends you have Isis and Nephthys. They are winged goddesses. They're not creatures like cherubim or sphinxes, but they, you know, they have outstretched wings. Okay, so you could argue that, you know, even that sort of feature is there, you know, on these boxes and whatnot, the poles, the whole bit. Despite the disconnections, let's just put it this way. There's a lot more going for this parallel than Assyrian palanquins and the Bedouin Kuba. There's just a lot more here. So let's just assume that, you know, we've got an Egyptian antecedent here to the ark. It would kind of make sense because the setting of Moses was raised, you know, in Egypt. He's the, you know, son of Pharaoh, and, you know, we know the whole story and whatnot. So the context makes sense. So we have to ask ourselves, do we have some scriptural or theological reason requiring us, that's an important term, requiring us to reject the idea that God could have instructed Moses to make an object similar to one with which he'd be familiar? Where's the rule against that? And you already know because I started the episode with these two questions. And I don't see this as a problem because, to go back to the two questions, why would we think the command that God gives, so let me just read it again, Exodus 25:9, Moses is supposed to make this stuff exactly as I show you concerning the pattern of the tabernacle, all its furniture, so you shall make it. Exodus 25:40. And see that you make them after the pattern for them, which is being shown you on the mountain. So God shows him that this pattern. Here's what I want built. Here's how to build it. So how is that incompatible with God deciding in the pattern he gives Moses to use objects or to create, you know, to give him instructions that Moses will, at least in part, and maybe foundationally, maybe in serious, significant ways, that he'll say, oh, okay, you know, I know what that looks like. I get it. I understand, you know, what you want here, because I've seen something like that before. Why is there some cosmic rule against that God is not allowed to instruct Moses using something familiar to Moses? Honestly, I can't think of a good reason why this would be a problem. I just can't. Again, God knows where Moses has been. He knows what Moses has seen. So, like, why not? Again, where's the rule against that? So these verses, Exodus 25:9-40, say simply that Yahweh told Moses how to design the ark. The passages don't say God said he would give Moses a design for an object unlike any other. The text never says that. God never says that. So I'd argue that any trepidation over the similarities is unnecessary and, to be blunt, kind of manufactured. So where does this put us? Again, I think it's pretty clear that Egyptian palanquins, these sacred barks, are likely a template for the ark. They're better than any other candidate, and there's lots of specific similarities. That is, God based his design instructions to Moses on something familiar to Moses. The parallel elements are pretty transparent, and there are a number of them. The Egyptian context of the Exodus and journey to Sinai are, of course, obvious. And Currid, this is in his commentary. It's not from his book, Egypt in the Old Testament. He has a commentary on Exodus that we've quoted before. Currid writes this: it is widely recognized that the design of the ark, and the entire tabernacle for that matter, is distinctly Egyptian. That is not a problem, Currid says, since God may have used a pattern or model which the Hebrews were accustomed to seeing and making as artisans in Egypt. Unquote. Hey, did we think of that, internet theologian, you know, who wants to somehow use the similarity to say something bad about the Bible? Did you ever consider that maybe some of the Israelites actually worked on these things? Huh? Okay, I mean, you know, this is entirely conceivable. And there's nothing, again, in the text or, you know, any sort of theological reason why that forbids God from doing this. So, again, there's no obstacle here. The tabernacle and the temple in general are not completely or even mostly different than other ancient Near Eastern temples. They have some of the same rooms, the same layouts, you know, the little niches. I mean, if you just look at these things, you can see that there are a lot of similarities. But, however, certain aspects that are different, either used different or look different or are absent in some cases, they do transmit certain theological distinctions in Israelite religion. There's no need for the design of something Israel is using, like a temple or an ark or the golden lampstand, the menorah, or the table of showbread, okay, the bread of the presence. There's no need for all those objects to be so 100% completely other than the stuff anybody else uses. What would that need be? So like an Egyptian priest, or excuse me, an Israelite priest, do we have to make sure that his robe is a different color than all of the other robes worn by priests in other ancient Near Eastern civilizations? Can it be the same length? Do the armholes have to be the same, you know, a different size? I mean, you know, where does this, I think, incoherent need for total otherness, where does it end? I mean, really, do Israelite priests and the objects they use in their worship, why must they be totally other? Now, by definition, it doesn't matter what shape or how they look. The fact, you know, is that how they're used and the meaning of their usage, and of course the deity that's being served by them, that's where the otherness comes in. There you need otherness, and you get it theologically. The differentiation is not transmitted, or it's not like hell, let's put it that way. The differentiation that's really important, the difference between Yahweh and these other gods, that isn't carried by the shape of things, or the color of things, or the design of things, objects. That is put forth and held in place by bigger ideas than what this box looks like. Okay, so again, I think this is a really misguided thing to sort of be concerned about. We mentioned last time, what about laws like the law code, the Ten Commandments? I mean, is there some cosmic rule that says everything listed in the Ten Commandments none of those things can be shared by other cultures? Israel's laws have to be 100% other and different. Why? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. So if Israel has a law, thou shalt not, you know, commit murder. So, yeah, I'm just so confused because I found a command against murder in a Babylonian law code. And, you know, oh, that's trouble for the Bible. It's just ridiculous. These are absurd thoughts. Honestly, I just have to be blunt here. But you see this kind of thinking on the internet all the time. You see a law or something, in this case, an object that bears resemblance to, either conceptually or in this case, physically, you know, to something in the Bible, you know, something from this pagan culture looks like this thing from the Bible, and we get shook up by that. Why? The theology isn't held in shapes and colors and objects. It's much more transcendent than that. You know, the issue is the content of the faith. That's what makes it different. And so, again, I want to belabor this point because I do run into this, you know, where people are so troubled. To me, that I just file this into the bucket that's labeled something like stuff that troubles people that really shouldn't trouble them at all, and they're just not thinking well about this thing. This is another one of those. So, you know, again, I don't think, you know, that we have a problem here for all of these reasons and others. You know, I'm going to try to stop beating this dead horse here. But there's just no theological reason God couldn't use something similar to hand to Moses and say, hey, make that. There's just no reason it had to be 100% other. Now, what I want to, you know, wind up with here is the question of what about the mix of Egyptian and Akkadian elements with respect to the Ark? And I'm specifically talking here about the cherubim. And we're going to see, again, we're going to see other things in part three when we go through the rest of the furniture. It's very Egyptian. There are things about the way the lampstand, the menorah, is described. It's very Egyptian. And let me just tip my hand here. you'll see again on the internet, and not only the internet, but in some academic sources about how the menorah, the golden lampstand inside the tabernacle, that's the Babylonian or Akkadian tree of life, and all. It's not. There are a number of fundamental disconnections between that and what we have in the golden lampstand. Nevertheless, the lampstand does convey this tree of life kind of thing, but it does it in an Egyptian way. It has no history or historical or thematic connection to something Babylonish. It's very Egyptian. We'll get to that in part three. It conveys the same idea, the presence of life, and it actually harkens us back to creation in specific ways. The bread of the presence does that. I mean, there are reasons why the objects are what they are, but they're all basically Egyptian, except for this odd designation of these supernatural, these guardians of sacred space, the cherubim, because it's an Akkadian term. And we have all this Egyptian flavoring here in this passage, as we're going to find out next week. And then right in the middle of it is an Akkadian term, cherubim. Like, what is going on with that? It's just odd. It is an outlier. It's the lone thing in the description that is just inconsistent. Now, if we ask, how is this explainable? Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I can't prove what I'm going to say from this point on, but I do have a suspicion. Okay, so this is speculation. This isn't exegesis. This is speculation. I have not seen any commentators address the oddity of an Akkadian term being employed for an object so Egyptian in a narrative whose context is Egyptian. So I'm going to take a crack at this. Again, what I'm going to say is speculative, but to me it makes kind of sense. It's workable. So let's assume that the two winged creatures atop the lid of the ark were Egyptian in character. Let's just assume that with Nogel. Okay, he calls them sphinxes. He doesn't have any textual basis for that. He just does it. Let's just assume that. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Some Egyptian figure. Okay. So let's just assume that, again, they're Egyptian in character, like basically everything else about the ark, sphinx-like creatures that had wings. If Moses was responsible for the textual description, if Moses is the one writing this, it makes zero sense, given his own Egyptian context, that he would use an Akkadian term to describe those figures. That just makes no sense at all. However, if the Torah was edited during the Babylonian period, it seems reasonable that readers of the Hebrew Bible would not be familiar with those Egyptian figures. While it's true that Isaiah uses, seraphim for its throne guardians in Isaiah 6, and that's Egyptian there, okay, while that's true, the Israelite kings of the 8th century BC, utilized Egyptian motifs because they were allies with Egypt against Assyria. This is Isaiah's time. So Isaiah is an outlier here. It's an oddity of its own. But you can see why it would happen there because of Ahaz and Hezekiah and all this stuff. Now, the exile was 200 years later. And there was no Egyptian context to the exile. This is Babylon. So again, it might make sense that in the Babylonian era that a scribe, while he's working on the Torah, again, putting it into its final form, could have updated the terminology of the ark construction narrative with a Babylonian term for the throne guardians so that readers would know what in the world they were. Because they're not going to be familiar with Egyptian terminology. They might have been familiar with Egyptian terminology like the seraphim in Isaiah's day because of the alliance with Egypt. It's kind of interesting, that if you actually go through the Hebrew Bible and look up all the places where cherubim occur, almost all of them are late. Okay, like you have Chronicles references, you've got contexts where you could make an argument that either the context of the particular passage is in the Babylonian period, or in the case of the Torah, was worked on, reworked during the Babylonian exile. There are some exceptions, though. There are a handful of texts that use the term cherubim that are not as late as the Babylonian period. Samuel, there's a couple, Kings, Isaiah 37. The rest are clearly Babylonian era or could be. But even those references in Samuel, Kings, and Isaiah 37 reflect monarchical times that are Assyrian. And Assyrian had the same word for the divine throne guardians, Karibu, Cherubim. The real outlier in all of this. In other words, I can give you an argument for a Babylonian or Assyrian-Babylonian context for every occurrence of the word Cherubim except for Isaiah 6, because there we don't have Cherubim, we have Seraphim. That's the only place where the Seraphim show up, that one passage. So that's really the outlier. You know, you'd basically have to say that Isaiah 6 is unique, and it actually is, to make this argument work, or this speculation. Again, all I'm doing is spitballing here. I'm speculating that what we have here is that we had an Egyptian, we had an ark back in Moses' day, and the things on top of the ark were of such a design that they would have been Egyptianized, like other things about the ark. But eventually, people would not know what those things were or what they represented. You know, not everybody has a Bible. It's just the priestly class, okay? And so what they did, what a scribe did, was he also called them Cherubim, so that people would know that these are divine throne guardians protecting sacred space. Again, that's pure speculation on my part. But I've not seen anyone even attempt to ask the question, hey, we have all this Egyptian stuff going on in Exodus 25, except for what these two things are called on the lid. That's Akkadian. How does that work? Again, I don't know. Now, to be a little more fair, but again, you have to hold the late view of the Exodus here. You could argue, well, even though they might have been Egyptian in form or appearance, they could have used Cherubim because, again, in the late period, the late date for the Exodus, that is very close to the period of the Amarna period, the Amarna Age. And the Amarna Age, there was lots of Akkadian, okay, in not only Egypt, but in Syria, Palestine, Canaan, because Akkadian was the language of international correspondence for this period. And so it's conceivable that Moses would have known Egyptian, he would have known his native language, Hebrew, and he would have known Akkadian as well. That's possible. But I'm still struck by the oddity of it, because why don't we see other terms mixed in with this Egyptian stuff? Why these? And again, maybe it's the best term. Maybe Moses is, it's just the best term, you know, to describe what these things are and what they do. I don't know. That's possible. But who knows? At the end of the day, who knows? So it's an incongruity. It's just something I wonder about. I've not seen anybody really tackle it. So again, I'm offering it for speculation, just, you know, because, hey, it's the podcast, and sometimes, you know, we just wonder about things. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm wondering about this. So I don't know. Again, I've not come across anything that makes more sense. So that's just something rattling around in my head that I wonder about, you know, how to resolve this incongruity. So next time, we're going to look at the other tabernacle furniture, and we're going to see that those items are also cast in Egyptian terms and motifs, which again makes the cherubim issue all the more of an outlier, because there's this Egyptian antecedent to it, the palanquin. Yes, there are differences. Again, God isn't being carried around in a box in ancient Israelite thought. He can't be contained. There is no idol. So there are differences. But I think the Egyptian material does, you know, merit consideration that, yep, probably, this is probably the model or part of the template for what's going on with the Ark of the Covenant. And we're going to see more Egyptian stuff in the other furniture, which again makes the cherubim issue all the more odd because of the terminology. So next time we'll look at the other tabernacle furnishings and what their meaning was. And I think you're going to find it very interesting on a conceptual level as to what these things stood for in the mind of the Israelite.
Mike, my question going into this episode is about the cherubim. How did they know what it looked like? You know, when they said, make two of them looking at each other. Well, in Ezekiel, you know, we kind of learned that they have four faces. And so that, you know, it says the ark, their faces are facing each other. Well, which face? You know, I mean, they didn't, like, there's no detail there. I mean, they didn't question. It's like, okay, we'll make two cherubims looking at each other, but it's not expounded upon.
Well, if Nogel would say the only thing that they could have visually, that could visually answer that question would be like Egyptian sphinxes or the Isis Nephthys, the winged, you know, women on either side of the palanquins. He would say that when they got these instructions, that's what popped into their heads because they had seen those before. Whereas in Babylon, they're going to have had, historically, they're going to have had prior contact before they ever get into exile in Babylon. They're going to have seen and had contact with like the Phoenicians. And the Phoenician thrones are actually the best parallels to the Ezekiel throne because there you have the cherubim, these like bovine kind of creatures with, you know, multiple faces. They're facing different directions. And then on top, they have the round circular platform. And then on top of that, you have a throne. It's just like Ezekiel 1. So they would have known what those look like. And then when they get into Babylon, you're going to get some of the same kind of motifs. You're going to have the wings, you know, as well. Maybe not multiple faces, but they would have had sort of a, in the Ezekiel case, again, he just has this vision. He's not told to make them. So when you see them, you know what it is. Okay. So they would have been familiar language to the people, you know, who would have been reading his book because they would have seen at least a couple different kinds of these things. They would have been able to intellectually, mentally place them, you know, identify what those were. But when it comes to this, yeah, you're right. There aren't any, you know, where would they have seen this? And again, if Nogal's sitting here, he's saying there's only one possibility for this, and that's something from Egypt because that's where they were. And I think Kurd is right that maybe some Israelites even worked on some of these things as craftsmen. So that's a roundabout way, again, of reinforcing an Egyptian context for the Ark. But that's a really good question.
Well, even going back and describing them in the garden with the flaming sword and whatnot.
See, you're talking to the guy that believes Genesis 1 through 11 was either written or heavily edited in Babylon. So that, I think that's what they're thinking there, because there's so many other Babylonish things. And that's just one of 20 or 30. So, you know, since I am driven to that position by all the other Babylonish things in Genesis 1 through 11, to me, that's not a difficult question to answer. The conception there would match Babylonian examples. So that's where they're getting the imagery from, or at least that's how they would have parsed the imagery in light of what they're reading. That's how they would have identified it mentally.
And of course, the cherubim are the ones responsible for the face melting.
Absolutely.
All right, Mike.
You're really stuck on the face melting. Do you have that as a screensaver?
No, but I just love that movie. That really affected me. When I was a child.
Maybe I gave you an idea there.
Yeah. I mean, as a child of the 80s, you know, when I saw that movie, I was so into it. And it stuck with me. So I know to keep my eyes shut and no matter what happens, don't look. I learned that lesson.
Right, don't look at the Ark. Don't look at the Ark.
Seriously. Get your face melted off. All right, Mike. Well, we look forward to part 3. This is an interesting one. So Ark's a big topic. Everybody likes it. I like it. It's one of my favorites. So who doesn't want to go be Indiana Jones and go look for the, you know, Ark of the Covenant?
I've got the original posters, man. I don't collect anything, but I did collect those. So.
And the jacket.
I get it. And the jacket. Yes, I get it. Yep.
All right. Well, I bet a ton of our listeners out there get it as well. So, well, with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.